Thank you, Rachel. I thank the steering committee and organizing committee for inviting me to be here today. I guess there's no slides there. These are my disclosures. I do consult for Rally Bio, and I will talk about one of their potential prophylactics, which is exciting, to treat fetal and neonatal thrombocytopenia later in the talk. This is our institute in Milwaukee, our research institute. And so I like to start with the nomenclature for the antigens that antibodies react against platelets to cause neonatal alloimmune thrombocytopenia. And I want to hit on insights today. You know, insights are things that are really important to know about a subject, and I talk to physicians quite often that don't understand this disorder. They've never seen a case, or if they've seen a case, it's been 5 years or more since they did, and they don't remember how they handled it or how to diagnose it. And so I take these calls every day, and I thought I'll share some of that information today. There may be individuals here that know those things, but some that don't. So our antigens are HPA, human platelet antigens. These are the six that we see antibodies most frequently to in neonatal alloimmune thrombocytopenia and most alloimmune platelet disorders. The HPA1A antigen is, of course, the one that we see the most frequently, especially in white populations, and it's the one that we study the most because of that. So we have the most information about it, but you can see that there's various glycoproteins that these antigens are carried on, and they all can be involved to some extent. This website over in the corner is where we maintain the antigens, and we see new ones every year. And so if you want a reference for where to go to see that, you can go to that site. Now you can see once you get past HPA5, the rest of them are just a B. The A is the high-frequency allele, and the B is the low-frequency allele. And so you can see these are all the low-frequency allele. We've never seen antibodies to the high-frequency allele, and probably for most of them, we may never, or it'll be a long time because they're so unusual to see. Most of these have been seen in only one case of fetal and neonatal alloimmune thrombocytopenia. But we're up to HPA35. Next month, we'll be voting on two more that have been submitted, so we'll be up to HPA37. And I put stars next to things that I think are very important to remember, and I put this one here because although these are low frequency, and you may never see one of these cases, or you may see one very infrequently, all of these antigens, antibodies against them, can cause fetal and neonatal alloimmune thrombocytopenia, and in order to diagnose a case, you need to be able to look for antibodies against these as well, not just HPA1A. So it's the platelet counterpart to hemolytic disease of the fetus and newborn, which you've heard most about today. It occurs in about 1 in 1,000 births, and there's 3.7 million births in the U.S. last year, so that's about 3,700 cases you could expect to see in 1 year in the United States. It counts for 3% of all neonatal thrombocytopenias and almost a third of cases where you have severe thrombocytopenia. Platelet counts less than 50,000. And approximately 15% of cases occur in first pregnancies, which you don't see in hemolytic disease of the fetus and newborn. So then most cases are discovered at birth because we have no screening programs for platelet-specific antigens. I think that's going to change in the near future. It is already changing in some countries where they're screening women for HPA1. And the majority of cases, the antibodies, it's a little bit different depending on different populations. In whites, I mentioned HPA1A, but HPA4 is more common to see in Japanese. And CD36, a glycoprotein on platelets, that in those cases, the mother simply has none of the protein. It's not an alloantigen. She just lacks the protein on her platelets and monocytes and can make antibodies against a fetus that exposes her to that protein. So this is the pathogenesis. I think we sort of already gone over it, but I used HPA1 as the example. The mother's 1BB. Her fetus is 1AB. The fetal platelets cross the placenta, and she's exposed and makes antibodies that come back and destroy the fetal platelets. And if the thrombocytopenia is severe enough, then you can have bleeding, and if you have very severe bleeding, you can have intracranial hemorrhage, and we want to make sure that that doesn't happen if we can. I mentioned that the thrombocytopenia is usually discovered at birth, and even without treatment, many of these cases will resolve on their own. And of course, the maternal platelet count's normal, and most of the reasons it's identified at birth is we see bruising on the infant and petechiae, and mainly mucosal bleeding. And just recently, the group in the Netherlands put out a paper just a couple years ago that confirmed what we kind of thought was the frequency of intracranial hemorrhage, which is 11 in 10,000 cases we can expect to see an intracranial hemorrhage. And the majority of those intracranial hemorrhages occur antenatally, so before 28 weeks. So sometimes we don't know, although we're doing more, you're doing more scanning to look for those things, that it's happening. Now there's a HLA class 2 antigen that's associated with their ability to make antibodies. And 30% of the white population will have that. It's called HLA-DR beta 301. And if you're 1BB woman and you don't have that antigen, only about half a percentage of those women will make an antibody. But if you have DR-beta-3-0101, you're 25 times more likely to make antibody. It doesn't mean you will, but you're much more likely. So about 13% of those women will make antibody. I think a key point here is, even if you have the perfect storm, you have this class 2 antigen and you're 1BB, doesn't make only about 13% of women actually make antibody. So there's other things we don't understand about why some women get immunized and others don't. And so the question that comes up a lot, is it important to know the DR-beta 301 status of a pregnant female that's 1BB? And I think an answer that later on. I think it can be with the new drugs that are coming out to treat this disorder, but right now we don't use it so much in making a diagnosis after a baby's identified at birth. So infants born with isolated thrombocytopenia, if you see an intracranial hemorrhage that occurs in the absence of any apparent cause, like anatomical defects or prematurity, then you might want to have a workup for fetal and neonatal albumin thrombocytopenia. But FNAIT and the confirmation's infrequent in a fetus that has just an isolated intracranial hemorrhage. We work those cases up almost every day in the lab, and extremely rare for us to see positive serology. So I think it can be important to rule it out, but it's important to let physicians know that rarely is that due to fetal and neonatal thrombocytopenia. And I think you have to be particularly vigilant with a pregnant woman that you serendipitously find that she's 1BB. So we screen a lot of blood donors to find donors that can be platelet donors for patients that have antibodies. And once in a while, we come across a woman of childbearing age that's HPA-1BB. And so we'll actually send a letter to her with information she can give to her doctor the next time she's pregnant or she gets pregnant for the first time so that they can manage a case since HPA-1's the most frequent and so difficult to deal with. This is a newborn that we actually worked up in our lab probably back in the early 90s, I think it was, that mother made HPA-1A antibodies and this baby died of intracranial hemorrhage, but you can see how badly affected it is. These are the antibody specificities that we see, antigens that we see the antibodies to the most frequently, so of course HPA-1's there, HPA-5B is the next most common, and then after that, it's smaller percentages of some of the other ones. But you can see we see combinations of antibodies sometimes, so there's a lot of different ways this presents. So what do you need to do for an optimal laboratory workup? And we'd like to do an intact platelet assay, and we want to do the capture assays, which helps us identify what antigen the antibody reacts with. And they go by different names. There's a MACE and a MAPA that's used in Europe more frequently, but in the United States we use the PABA. And then another one of these stars for something you should want to remember is if mother has antibodies to one of those low-frequency B antigens I talked about, you have to do a cross-match of the mother's serum with the father's platelets. If you don't, you're not going to detect it because nobody has those on their panels of platelets that they use for antibody detection. So it's really important to do that test to know that that's the cause. And then we do genotyping of the parents. We match up that the parents have an incompatibility and that mother has antibody to that, and that's how we determine that it is FNAIT. We also sometimes, if we don't find antibodies, we're not sure, and we think clinically it really looks like a case, we'll do things like gene sequencing for rare antigens. I've seen cases of ABO FNAIT before. They're rare, but we've seen them. And CD36, we don't have genotyping for that because it's whether you have the protein or not, so we use special phenotyping methods for that, but we may resort to that depending on the ethnicity of the mother and the father. And then HLA comes up a lot. A lot of women that have had a pregnancy will have class 1 HLA antibodies, but they don't have babies with thrombocytopenia and hemorrhages. So it's hard to implicate those. I think most class 1 HLA antibodies don't cause neonatal alloimmune thrombocytopenia, but maybe particularly strong ones do. And a couple years ago, or this is just to prove how important it is to do the cross match with the father. This was the low frequency antigen 32B that we discovered in our lab, and if we hadn't done this cross match and showed that the mother only reacts with the father's 2 GP2B 3A, you can see it was 130 versus a cutoff of greater than or equal to 5, whereas in the panel, she was completely negative. So where can you send these? What are the labs? I think it's important to go to a lab that has this experience. And so these are the members of the Platelet Immunology Working Party of the International Society of Blood Transfusion. There's 30 labs. They represent 19 countries. And you can see that in Europe, there's actually quite a few of them. So that's a good thing. And in France, there's actually 3 labs, so you have a good choice of labs that you can send your samples to get good testing. So how do they treat the newborn in most cases is observation. Many of these children will, if they're not having any active bleeding, their platelet counts are starting to rise, that they will recover without treatment. Otherwise, if you need to give platelets, HPA negative platelets are important, and sometimes IVIGG can be added to get a better response. Random platelets are fine to give. You just may have to give more of them, but that won't hurt the infant to give random platelets if it's necessary. And then washed maternal platelets can be given as well because, of course, they lack the antigen. So I just thought, take all this information and go over a case that came out of our lab. It was a 26-year-old G1P1 group O female, and the father. It was an uncomplicated full-term delivery. And then the male child bled profusely after circumcision, day 2 of life, and the platelet count when it was checked was 5,000 platelets per microliter. Head scan showed 2 central nervous system bleeds and 1 looked to have occurred antenatally. They gave random platelet transfusions and they failed, and you'll see why in a minute because of the antibody that was formed. And they transfused, then washed maternal platelets, and they were able to get the platelet count up to 50,000, and the baby did fine after that. So this is the PABA serum results on the mother, and you can see in those grayed out boxes, there's 200s. Those are reactions of her serum with HPA 1A positive platelets, whereas with the like T2 and T5, those are HPA 1BB platelets, she's negative. So it's an HPA 1A antibody. The mother was 1BB and the father 1A positive. And they're also incompatible for HPA 5, but we looked for antibodies to that. That would be the GP 1A-2A line, which is all negative. So, you know, just having an incompatibility doesn't mean you'll make antibody. That's important to keep in mind. And so what do we do with this for this family going forward? Well, we can type the fetus in the next pregnancy if the dad's heterozygous, which he was in this case. And there's a 50% chance the fetus will inherit 1B from the father and be 1B homozygous. You don't have to treat or do anything. But if the baby inherits the 1A antigen, then most times in the States, we would give IVIGG and start it and give the dosage depending on how badly affected that original fetus was. If the father's homozygous 1A, then there's no need to do fetal genotyping because we know the fetus will be 1A positive. I mean, all other fetuses. And then What do you do when there's no maternal antibodies detected, but you really strongly believe that clinically it looked like a case of fetal and neonatal alarmin thrombocytopenia? We'll do, in the States, what we call serial monitoring. So we'll check the mother for antibodies at 12 weeks, 24 weeks, and 32 weeks to see if the antibody shows itself in the next pregnancy. And if it does, then start treatment. But if no antibodies to an HPA antigen appear or are detected, then do nothing. So we're back to what about the HLA antibodies again. This is a study we published a couple years ago. There's been other groups that have found similar information. If you look at the strength of an HLA antibody in a woman that had a baby with thrombocytopenia and you don't find an HPA-specific antibody, those mother's antibodies are stronger than a woman that has a baby that doesn't have thrombocytopenia but she has HLA antibodies. And the specificity of the antibodies is broader. But we couldn't determine from the work that we did, is there a certain cutoff or how strong an antibody, HLA antibody, has to be to maybe empirically treat with IVIGG in the next pregnancy? We just couldn't determine that. I know for samples that come through my lab what that is. A strong antibody's got a value in my lab of around 400. And Ken Moise sent me a case several years ago where the mother had a first child born with a 7,000 platelet count and intracranial hemorrhage. And when we worked up the mother's antibody, it was very strong, but it was all HLA, but it would cause platelet clumping and it caused a lot of cross-reactivity in our test. And it was telling us that this is a particularly strong antibody, and so he empirically treated that next pregnancy and that baby was born with a normal, well, close to normal platelet count, but no other effects. And so that was the right thing to do. And he's gonna need to do that in all her subsequent pregnancies. But I think that's rare, but it happens sometimes. You just need to understand the capability of your tests. And then what do we do when you treat the next pregnancy? Most groups I see now and in the literature is about 1 gram per kilogram per week. That's about almost 99% effective in preventing an intracranial hemorrhage in that next pregnancy. But there's, you've heard a lot of talk about IVIGG. There's oftentimes shortages of it. It's expensive. There are side effects, and it's not 100% effective. Steroids. From some of the conversations I've been having with colleagues in the last few years, not as many places are using them as they used to because of some of the side effects, I think. And then a lot of talk here for red cells, which makes sense, but for maybe platelets not, is peri-umbilical blood sampling to get fetal platelet counts or to give platelets. In the platelet community, that's frowned upon. We don't really recommend it anymore. I know there's a few places in Canada, and I think I heard the other day a group in Poland that does this still. But I think for most of Europe, and especially in the United States, this isn't used. So what are some more recent developments in fetal and neonatal alarmin thrombocytopenia? And one is to look at risk. What's a high risk versus a low risk pregnancy in a woman that's HPA 1BB and has antibodies to HPA1A. This is a group the Norwegians did. They used a cohort from their country of 64 pregnancies they called low risk, and they based low risk off of what the antibody level was. And they do that with the MAPE assay, and they say an antibody level below 3 international units per milliliter is low risk, and above that is high risk. And so out of the 64 low risk pregnancies with no treatment with IVIGG, none of them got an intracranial hemorrhage. But of the high-risk group, out of 7, 2 of them got an intracranial hemorrhage. And then they had a control group that was based on looking back at studies in the past from all over the world. And they had 313 pregnancies, and all of these were treated with IVIGG. In the low-risk pregnancies, out of 313, there was 2 that got an intracranial hemorrhage despite getting IVIGG. And out of the 90 that got IVIGG, they were high risk, still 5 of them got an intracranial hemorrhage. So there's a little bit of some issues with this study in that almost all those babies in the low and high risk group in the group that didn't get treated with IVIGG had a C-section at 1 to 2 weeks before their delivery and got compatible platelets right after that. So it may have biased their study a little bit, but it suggests there's an opportunity for us to assign risk and perhaps use less IVIGG than we've used in the past. The ability to do cell-free fetal DNA typing. Red cell people are a little ahead of us on that. There's not as many labs that do this testing. I know Rachel's lab here in Paris does it, and she was very graciously able to help us develop that, and we just validated our test last year for cell-free fetal DNA for HPA1. It's a great test. We had 100% accuracy matching between both laboratories. I want to thank Rachel for all her help for us to do that. But now all we need to do is draw a blood sample on the mother and isolate the cell-free DNA, and we don't have to do amnios anymore. So I think this is going to be really helpful to us going forward. And I think for some of these drugs I'm about to talk about, we're going to definitely have to have that in more laboratories if you're going to use those methods. So this is a prophylactic drug. It's in clinical trials right now from RallyBio. RallyBio is a company in Connecticut in the U.S. that acquired this drug from a group in Norway and Sweden that had previously been developing it and trying to get it to the market. And in this study, I'm not going to go into the details, but the blue lines are where they've treated with the prophylactic. The prophylactic is an anti-HPA human IgG anti-HPA1A. They have a polyclonal form, but I think they've sort of gone away from that now, and they have a monoclonal that they're using and probably will use in their clinical trials. And you can see that if you took males that are 1BB and you transfused them with 1A positive platelets and gave this antibody, that it cleared them from their system before they could be immunized against HPA1A. So it showed that it can work, the mechanism. This was some work that's been done recently by Peter Newman and his wife Deb Newman, who are at our institute at Versity. They have a mouse model of HPA1A FNAIT. We didn't have very good mouse models in the past. This one's very good. It's mouse GP2B3A, and on the 3A component, the human HPA1A epitope is there. And so they actually can, these mice can be immunized, the mother mice, and then breed with male mice that are 1A positive, and the 1A positive pups will get thrombocytopenia and intracranial hemorrhages. And they showed here is that if you gave the RallyBio drug to the mother mice, you got no maternal HPA1A antibody production. The pups had no antibody in their circulation, suggesting it didn't cross over in the placenta. And the pups' platelet counts there in that right top purple and yellow bars were normal. And so it showed, at least in a mouse model, that this can work as well. And so this was a recent poster they had at the American Society of Hematology in December, just a month ago, where they did more of this work, and they got the concentration down to 1 microgram per kilogram or 5 micrograms per kilogram. And in that B slide there, you can see the gray bars where they didn't treat, and those mother mice made antibodies, whereas the pink bars on the right, they didn't make antibody at either concentration of the drug. Again, suggesting this drug will do what it needs to do. And they also could prevent fetal thrombocytopenia in the pups. And if they gave pups that to mother mice that hadn't been immunized to HPA1A, if they gave the drug to them, their platelet counts were fine at both concentrations, showing the drug itself doesn't cause any problems with the pups in utero. So it looks like it's promising. These are two of the studies that they have going on right now for this drug called RallyBio 212. It's an HPA1A monoclonal, and they're just finishing up a natural history study of, they won't reach 30,000 mothers screened, but they'll probably be somewhere close to 22,000. And these are women that have, they're 1BB, they have the DR-beta-0301 marker that makes you more likely to make antibody, and they don't have antibody yet. They're screened for it, and they have a fetus that's 1A positive, and then they follow those pregnancies through to the end to see what happens, and will help them inform further studies down the road. Their phase 2 trial is a pregnant women that are at higher risk for HPA1A, so basically the same qualifications at the natural history study, but then it'll be an intervention study, and they'll give the drug to see whether it works. So it's exciting. I think they're probably, I think they maybe they've enrolled the first case, so we'll see in the future. I won't talk about this because Ken Moise graciously went through it in his talk, so we know how these FcRn blockers work. And, of course, Janssen has this nipocalimab that Ken showed his data on for hemolytic disease of the fetus and newborn. They have Frisia 1 and Frisia 3, and Frisia 1 is a double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled trial for just HPA-1A pregnancies in which the mother has a 1A-positive fetus. And then they have Frisia 3, which is an open-label, multi-center study, and they're going to enroll 1A and 5B cases. So 5B, I said, was the second most common antibody we see in neonatal albumin thrombocytopenia. So they will be looking at both of those, and that would be in alloimmunized women. So this drug would be used differently. RallyBio's drug will prevent antibody production, sort of like Rh immune globulin does, whereas the nipocalimab will prevent somebody that already has antibody, that antibody from crossing the placenta and causing FNAIT. So it'll be very exciting to see how these turn out once we have data. And then lastly, I just want to say these are the things I think that we need to do right now to get us just over that next line. And one is to develop and validate antibody testing for levels of HPA-1A antibodies in mothers so we can define risk. And not many of our labs have these tests. I know we don't in ours, and we're working on it. But some in Netherlands and some in Norway have these tests. And then we, as labs across the world, we need to agree on what that level is. Right now, there's some disagreement about what's the magic level that you treat or you don't treat at. And then more labs in that picture of 30 labs I showed you need to develop cell-free fetal DNA testing. And I said, we just did it last year in our laboratory. Rachel has it. There's a few other labs that have it in the Netherlands and Norway, I think. Rachel just put out a survey so we can see how many of those labs in the platelet immunology working party have it or don't, and how are they doing it, and how does it look different between labs. And I think that'll be very important information for us to have. And with that, I thank you again for your time, and thank you, Rachel.